broadcasting through a gramophone with a newly turned crank. It's the Funk Zone Podcast with your host, Ted Mills.
Why, hello, 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 folks. Welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast. This is episode 66. Clickety click, 66. I am your host, Ted Mills. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. This is the show where I interview artists and creative people, and I try to find out why they do what they do. My guest for today's show is not an artist, but he's in charge of preserving and curating a big chunk of the arts from the 20th century. We have David Soibert on the show today, and he is curator of the Performing Arts Collection at the UCSB Library and is in charge of their massive collection, of wax cylinders and 78 RPM records from back in the day. I've known David for many years now, and in fact, he is the guy who got me back into vinyl, into buying records and such. And I'd become friends with his roommate, and I'd gone over for a dinner party. And by the end of the evening, everybody was jibber-jabbering on the sofa. And I was checking out his record collection and his excellent turntable. And I think he put on a Cannes Tago Mago. And I was just like, oh my God, this sounds so good. Why don't I dust off my turntable? I've had one for ages. Why don't I do that? And so I did. And my friends and my family know how that obsession is going with piles and piles of records. And yes, I'm one of those guys who will tell you vinyl sounds better than CD, but with caveats which are too tedious to go into in this introduction. Anyway, David and his department at the UCSB Library recently moved into a fancy new building, and I got a tour of the new facility. There are thousands and thousands of records, all cataloged and in nice new sleeves. But more importantly, over the years, the library has been busily digitizing their collection for all of us with an internet connection to check out. So you could go to all that stuff. cylinders.library.ucsb.edu. to start browsing the collection. Of course, there will be a link in on the page for this episode, so you can just click on it. And there you'll see like curated playlists of the different things in the collection, from spoken word to banjos to that Ukrainian fiddle player that we mentioned in passing several times. Anyway, go check it out. It is a fascinating collection, and every, I don't know how often, but quite often they are putting up new recordings because they're digitizing everything slowly. If you see how much they have to do, you know that they have a lot of work on their hands. In this interview, we talk about the collection, about copyright issues, about wax cylinders and how they were sold, what they were about. Along with a little bit about David himself and like how he parlayed his love of music into his job and how he went from a record collector into basically a record collector at a university and getting paid to do it. What? Okay. And just a quick shout out to UCSB Library for having me and obviously to David for giving me the full tour. They have art and manuscripts and rare books and all that kind of stuff in the special collections, not just music. I got to see a folio, first folio of Shakespeare, just sitting there on the shelf. Check that out. So, and it's all accessible to the general public with some rules and such. So, but you can do it. It's a library. It's there for you. So check it out if you're in the area. Okay, briefly about me. I told you last week I was sick. We're recovering from being sick, but I'm all better now. And now I'm trying out a juice cleanse. A juice cleanse. Now, I've done cleanses before, and I speak well of them, but I always forget how those first couple of days go. And for those who've done it, I think you probably know it's pretty hardcore because you just think about food all the time. And plus, you get headaches and whatever. But more than that, you get a sense of, oh my God, why am I doing this? That's the main thing to come out of my body is this, oh God, why? why am I doing this? On the other hand, you don't have to worry about dinner so much because, hey, it's in a jar. There you go. And that's all you get. So, hey, juice cleanse. By the time next episode rolls around, I'm sure I'll be back to eating garbage. Well, okay, not eating garbage. I'm going to try and make it better than garbage, but I'll be eating solid foods. Yay. Yay for me. Will it have affected me? I'll let you know. I'll let you know next week. Okay. Meanwhile, you can follow me on Twitter at Ted Mills, and you can like us on Facebook at the Funk Zone Podcast page there. Go click like. It all helps. And you can subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher and wherever you get your podcast fix. You can also show your support by pledging as little as $1 a podcast over at our page at patreon.com/funkzonepodcast. That is one donut a week, right? $1 a podcast is like one donut a week. One delicious, greasy, sugary, donut. Okay, maybe not the best comparison to make right now, but just consider it a cheap thing. Okay. Okay, folks, let's get this interview going with David Soibert, recorded January 11th, 2016, at the UCSB Library and now digitized by interns for your listening pleasure. Here we go. David Soibert, welcome to the Funk Zone Podcast.
Thank you, Ted.
How you doing?
I'm wonderful.
Yeah, I love this new building smell.
It's incredible.
Right? We are sitting in, what's the official title of this building? Special Collections.
We're the Department of Special Research Collections at the UC Santa Barbara Library.
Uh-huh. And your official title is here?
I'm the curator of the Performing Arts Collection.
Mm-hmm. And we just had a tour, which right. You do not see on this this podcast, but had a tour of all three stories. It goes on forever and ever and ever. And it has one of the biggest collections, right, of vinyl or of 10-inch 78s.
Right, 78 RPM shellac records, not vinyl, people.
Oh, that's right. Let's get that right.
Yeah.
What the kids today may call vinyl, but they'd be sorely wrong.
People refer to everything as vinyl if it fits on a turntable, but there's been a variety of different types of materials that have gone into making what we call records, and the archive here is predominantly, I roughly say, sort of pre-World War II in its temporal focus, which is largely 70 RPM shellac recordings and cylinder recordings, wax cylinders.
In fact, last year I did a story on the... getting into this
into the National Recording Registry.
Yes, National Recording Registry.
Part of the initiative of the Library of Congress.
Sorry.
It's like the National Film Registry, but for recordings. It was started about 10 years after the Film Registry. So people are pretty familiar with the Film Registry, things like Birth of a Nation and Star Wars and all that kind of stuff are on the Film Registry. They're less familiar with the Recording Registry, which has... Are recordings of great cultural, aesthetic, or historical importance, everything from, you know, Edison's first surviving recording to Miles Davis' Kind of Blue and that sort of thing. But the library here at UCSB, a group of what we call vernacular home recordings was inducted into the National Recording Registry last March.
What was interesting is that right at the beginning of this technology, it's more democratic than it became. And then it became democratic again with tape. But, yes, right at the beginning, those wax cylinders you could record on and send them to your family, right?
Right. Very early, the media was sold, much kind of like cassette tape would have been in the 80s or 90s, where it was something that you either purchased pre-recorded music for entertainment purposes or you bought blank cassettes and you would record your kids or record your grocery lists or whatever you wanted to do, but it was a two-way medium that was used pretty equally for both. And the early sound recordings were that way too. The wax cylinder recordings were that way, where you could record them or you could consume them. And it was really later then, after the wax cylinder kind of went out of favor around World War I, where you had the disc media was really a one-way, you know, the record companies would record things that they thought would sell and try to sell them to the public. And that remained that way really until the introduction of tape in the 1950s, when then people again began to make their own recordings at home or record live concerts and things like that. Mm. So yeah, there's a real unique snapshot time period in there from, say, the mid to late 1890s up and through, you know, roughly World War I or something like that, where you have a small but interesting number of home recordings, homemade recordings that survive. And they have this unique snapshot into kind of what everyday people were interested in and wanted to record. And just as an aside, this differs from the whole other subgenre of recordings, which would be like ethnographic recordings or field mm-hmm. recordings. Those are largely made for scientific purposes. People affiliated with museums or with cultural institutions would go out into the field and, say, record languages or record music. But that was specifically for the purpose of preservation and study, whereas the ones that the home recordings were not intended for preservation or study. They were very ephemeral, just for people to, you know, maybe make, and they'd play them back a year later for their kids and say, hey, remember Grandpa last year? Here was his, you know, 82nd birthday.
Yeah.
And then they could listen to him again.
Yeah, there's a real charming one that you sent out where the guy is speaking to the future.
Right.
It's like, I might be dead when you hear this, but here's the sound of my voice. It's very aware already of what the technology is.
Yeah, and that's very early on, because the earliest recordings that you could kind of make as a consumer were, I mean, we could argue over the year, but let's just say 1896 was mm-hmm. about the first time you could go out and buy a machine, buy blank records, and make your own recordings. But I think people very early took to it in mm-hmm. in memorializing birthdays and things like New Year's celebrations and kind of momentous life events where they would break this out and make recordings. Or in the case of one of the other ones, where we have a recording of a woman named Rachel Wambaugh, and she was born in the 1820s, and this recording was made in the 1890s. So she was alive when Thomas Jefferson was alive. And so here we have this woman making this recording at this late in her life in the 1890s, and she's this kind of window back to really almost our colonial era, or at least the early era of the Republic. And I find that fascinating, that we have this kind of unbroken continuum all the way, almost 200 years old now.
Yeah, and you could erase those wax cylinders too, right?
Yeah,
you just shave it off.
That's the ephemeral nature of them. Is you would, you know, the machines would come with a shaving apparatus, or you could buy a shaver, and just like you would hit the erase button on a tape and use it over again, with these you would just shave off the cylinder and record over it again, and you could do that over and over, and that really stems from the media's earliest uses, which was as a business dictation format. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, your secretary would record a letter, and then she would type it out and transcribe it, and then she would shave the cylinder and then reuse it over and over again. So that feature was kind of designed really for that office, very practical application, but also meant that you could reuse these early recordings multiple times.
And one of the things that you do here, which is not just collecting them and storing them, but digitizing them. What's that process like? Is that scary when it sounds like you get one shot with these things.
Well, there's a perception that these are very fragile, and there's some truth to that. But, you know, with the proper training and the technology and equipment, we have a pretty good handle on the whole digitizing process. So we've been digitizing here at the library since 2002 is when we started. And we were one of the first kind of institutional collections to put a large number of our historical recordings on the web for people to download. Now, 2002 is kind of post-Napster, in that the public had been exposed to the possibilities of sort of large-scale music consumption through the internet, but this was really before YouTube and iTunes Store and that kind of thing, where you could go and have sort of, whereas now with Spotify, we're literally like almost anything you can comprehend is out there somewhere on the internet.
Yeah.
And there certainly were a lot of ways to download music on the internet in 2002, but in terms of unlocking this historical content from the late 19th century and early 20th century, we were really one of the first places to do that, particularly on a mass scale, where when we went online with our what's now called the UCSB Cylinder Audio Archive in 2005, our initial kind of upload to the internet, if you will, was about 5,000 cylinders. Mm. And that reflected my own philosophy of how to do what we call digital projects, which was not a particularly curated approach. Mm-hmm. At that time, when digital projects were expensive and somewhat exploratory in nature, there were a lot of libraries, archives, museums who would say, okay, let's pick our 200 best photographs of the American West, or let's pick our 100 great, you know, oral histories that we've done over the past few years, that kind of thing, and put those online. So those were kind of boutique projects that were done by libraries and archives. And I said, let's just put it all up and let the users curate and let them kind of sort it out. And when you're talking early sound recordings, there's an acquired taste in a couple of respects. One, that music has changed a lot, mm-hmm. that a lot of the musical, the style of performance and the type of songs that were written were very different than they are now. And not even different between, say, like, you know, the Beatles and hip-hop or something like that, but just everything is foreign about some of these. And so you really have to kind of get in a mental space and kind of learn the language and understand. You know, it's like reading Chaucer or something like that, that it's very beautiful once you kind of have given the tools to understand the vocabulary. But until you have figured it out, it just sounds kind of can be not very aesthetically approachable. Yeah. So that's one aspect, is learning the language. And the other one is, just because a lot of these recordings have deteriorated, there's pops and clicks and surface noise and skips and scratches. And your ears will become accustomed and just tune that out eventually, mm-hmm. the way that you can drive down the freeway with lots of noise in the car and you can still hear your driving companions and converse with them, because you just tune out the road noise. Same sort of thing with these. But so we took an approach where we were going to let the users curate their own experience. We wanted to provide them tools to do that, but we really wanted to put it all up, regardless of whether we thought it was aesthetically significant or not. We thought from this little window of time between the 1890s and, say, World War I, that let's just give people a whole musical world to explore.
Mm. Did you follow what people were clicking on, though, to see what they were curating, what they tended to go towards? Did you have a top 10?
Well, people always look for jazz. That's the kind of the first thing that people... Old music, old jazz. And that doesn't really work so much, because on the cylinder format, I mean, the first jazz recordings were around 1917. Mm-hmm. Jazz had existed prior to that, but that was the first sort of putting the recordings on wax. But it wasn't, the cylinder companies weren't the ones that were the pioneers in bringing authentic jazz to the public. Mm-hmm. But that's what people tend to gravitate towards, and I think they kind of often come up empty-handed. Mm-hmm. There is some decent jazz on cylinder recordings, but by and large, the jazz came of age in the 20s, and by then it was the 78 RPM disc, mm-hmm. and it was companies like Jeanette and OK and Victor and companies like that, mm-hmm. that never made cylinders, that were really the pioneers in bringing that to the public.
Mm-hmm. So 5,000 initial.
Right.
Is there more now?
There is more now.
What's the number?
We're between 10 and 11,000 that we've digitized and put online.
And they're all like 4 minutes each, right?
Yeah, between two and four minutes. They were up until about 1908, they were 2 minutes, and after that they were four. But the collection has continued to grow. We're actually behind. We're pushing 16,000 cylinder recordings in the collection here. And, you know, 10 or 11,000 of them are online. And we're working diligently to digitize the rest of them, but we've gotten a little behind, but we're working to catch up.
How many people work on that? How many people are just putting cylinders to digital bits every day?
Amazingly, this is one of those projects that, I mean, we all get paid here, so I can't say it's a labor of love, but the running of the cylinder project is, there's probably five or six people here in the library who are involved in some way, but nobody works on it full time. We've got digitizing technicians who spend part of their time doing that. We've got catalogers who spend part of their time. I'm the curator, and I spend a portion of my time, but I'm responsible as well for the rest of the recorded sound and audiovisual archives here, as well as the American Discography Project and the Performing Arts Archives. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's a dedicated group of people who are passionate about making those recordings heard. We've had interns. We had an intern from Reed College in the summer 2015, and he digitized a bunch of cylinders and wrote Facebook posts, and that's a way we get the message out to social media of putting things up that people can kind of dig into the collection and then start clicking links and, you know, that old web hyperlinking where you end up in kind of what do they call it, a YouTube hole?
Yeah, you've gone. The old rabbit hole?
Yeah.
How did I get here? Why am I listening? Yes, exactly. Yeah. And you had a tweet or a post or something from Neil Gaiman who found you guys?
Yeah.
What was he listening to?
I don't know what he was listening to, but Boing Boing posted about our 10,000 cylinder milestone a couple months ago, and then Neil Gaiman posted that on his Tumblr. And I guess Neil Gaiman's Tumblr must have a lot of followers because, you know, our internet traffic went way up again, and lots of retweets or retumbles or whatever they're called.
What do they call it? A retumble?
Retumble.
But you also have this, so that's the cylinder collection, but there's the 10 inches as well. And you have, how many did you say?
Right, yeah. So the wax cylinder collection's about 16,000, which is fairly mind-blowing. I mean, we're probably the third largest collection in the country, along with the Library of Congress and Syracuse University. Mm-hmm. But our collection of historical recordings, the 78 RPM shellac discs, is an order of magnitude bigger. There's over 200,000 discs.
200,000?
Yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, I saw it. And it was, I can't even take it in. Really.
It's an entire range of shelving.
And,
you know, there are half a dozen very large archives of sort of pre-war sound recordings in the country, Stanford, Yale, Library of Congress, New York Public. But we're somewhat unique in a couple of ways in that our collection's international in scope, which I think is very reflective of UCSB as an institution, the fact here that we're on the Pacific Rim. So our collections are from really all over the world, continental Europe, Latin America, Africa. We probably have the largest collection of African 78s outside of Africa.
Is this African pop music at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like Folkways went over to record.
Right.
This is coming from the country itself.
Yeah. These are all commercial recordings, not ethnographic or field recordings. So it's not, these weren't meant for the study of the technique of how you play the Amadinda or some instrument. It was, here's an African pop band and we're going to record them and try to sell records.
Yeah.
But they're very rare nonetheless. I mean, you know, from this time period in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, in Africa in particular, for a whole host of reasons, just the nature of the industry over there, the climate, the war, poverty, that you know, if you're escaping a civil war, you don't take your 78 RPM discs with you. You take your kids and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And so the survival rate of these recordings is much smaller than, say, you know, like opera records in the West, which tended to be owned by wealthy people who were stable and passed them on through the generations. And you can still find Caruso 78s in excellent condition all over the place. They're not that rare. On the other hand, a lot of these international recordings, whether they're from Latin America or Africa or South Asia, are rare. Mm. So we focused on that aspect of the collection. And then the other thing is we focused on access. I've always believed that that was why libraries exist, is we're not here. I mean, we have an archival preservation function, which is, you know, the kind of the bunker mentality of when the cockroaches are left, we'll still have these records
of this music.
Yeah, of humanity for the Star Trek people that come along later and find it. But I believe that the collections should be accessible to the public and should be easily accessible to the public. And in this day and age, that means, you know, online digital access.
Yeah. So how many of these records are online?
Well, we've put through our partnership with the Library of Congress National Jukebox, we've put an additional 10,000 records online, and there's probably close to 20,000 more that are in the pipeline.
Wow.
And our goal really is we have an agreement with Sony Music Entertainment in New York that we can digitize anything that they own from the acoustical era, which is pre-1925, and we can put that online for free.
Mm.
So Sony has given us that authority to do that. And between our collection, Library of Congress, and our partner institutions, which includes Stanford, University of Wisconsin, other places, you know, we're looking at collectively, we probably have somewhere in the neighborhood of 45,000 recordings that we can digitize and put online, and we're working towards that. And that means that it's all available, you know, at a click. You don't have to go into the archive.
Mm-hmm.
Our function is a behind-the-scenes function in terms of facilitation and preservation and digitization and all that kind of stuff. But we really want to meet you on your desktop, just like this podcast, and deliver it to you at home.
Yeah, all these links that we're talking about will be on the page for this episode. So you can go to funkzonepodcast.com, scroll down, and have at it. And then go disappear down the
hole.
Internet hole. But that leads into one of areas of interest that we've talked about over the years, which is the weirdness of copyright and who owns it, this belief that you could possibly still make money from it, but then there's a lack of interest. Where do we stand with that compared to when we originally talked about it? Because it was some weird limbo, wasn't it?
Yeah, and nothing much has changed. There's a common perception among the public that there's this kind of magical old number, and everything before that is public domain, mm-hmm. and everything after that is under copyright. And people are well aware of that because of the Disney situation when Steamboat Willie was going to go into the public domain, and then Disney got the copyright law changed, and that was the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act of 1998, I think it was. The complicating factor here is that sound recordings are really an entirely different species entirely.
Mm.
Sound recordings, when Congress passed the 1909 copyright law, they were left out. And they were actually left out until 1972. So there is no federal copyright on recordings before 1972, which is why if you look at a Beatles LP at the back, there's no copyright symbol on it. And if you look at a CD reissue, there is. But so that was the big change in 1972 when Congress rewrote the law to include sound recordings. There's stuff online that you can read about the why and the how of all that, which isn't really that. It's worth further reading if you're interested, but it's not totally germane to the problems that we have in dealing with early sound recordings. That early sound recordings are protected by state law, not by federal law, which is a whole
state law.
Right. So in California, there's an anti-piracy law, which was written to protect record companies from, you know, bootleggers selling records out of the trunk of their car and stuff like that, but broadly applies to all sorts of things.
So that's based upon the company being in the state?
Well, and that's a good question. I mean, we've seen lawsuits that that, you know, in New York State, which involved Capitol Records, and Capitol is based in California, but it's a subsidiary of, well, they had a cross-licensing agreement with an English company. So it's all very complicated. And these days, it doesn't really matter because all, you know, the internet is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we just have to assume that all these recordings before 1972 are somehow protected by copyright. And we need to find ways to, I don't want to say get around that, because the point isn't to break the law. The point is to provide a way for the public to access these recordings for their personal use or their research or study. Mm-hmm. Fair use is one way. Fair use is something that's written into the copyright law, which says that you have the right to, you know, use copy materials for the purpose of criticism or study and things like that. Educational use is widely considered fair use. Mm-hmm. But in the case of these early sound recordings, we had decided that probably the best, the most effective way is, let's just go to the record company and ask their permission. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of market for early recordings. I mean, you know, Caruso and Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong probably still make money for the record companies. But most of this stuff long ago stopped being of any commercial interest. And it's really in the company's best interest just to kind of liberate it for the purposes of preservation and access and whatever else. So that's what Sony did when they gave the gratis license to the Library of Congress and UCSB to put these recordings online. Mm. So that was our way of getting around the whole copyright problem. But it hasn't gone away, and Congress hasn't shown any inclination towards doing anything about it.
I mean, so if I found, say, a 78 recording, say I went onto the site and I find this 78 recording on this obscure label, not a major label, but a label that doesn't exist anymore, and then I want to use it, say, in a film, am I allowed to do that? Or do I have to go and find the company, track down, do I owe publishing money to this person who wrote it about 100 years ago? I mean, what conundrum can I get into with this?
I don't know what the actual legal ramifications are going to be, but I mean, the interesting thing is, if you used a 100-year-old recording, mm-hmm. the copyright to the song would have been expired, because mm-hmm. that would be, you know, that's not the recording, that's the paper that was, the song was written on, the words and the music.
So let's say it's 1915. I find a song that was written in 1915.
So the copyright to the song would be expired, so you would not owe any publishing royalties to the songwriter, mm-hmm. but the copyright to the sound recording would still be in that legal limbo land where it's protected under state law. Mm-hmm. So you may very well owe some sort of royalties to the record company, and it would be something that you would just have to, if you were putting in an independent film, mm-hmm. to go to the record company and say, I want to use this recording. Can you send me a master license agreement so I can use this recording? Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, they'll probably never write you back, because if your last name isn't Lucas or Spielberg, they're probably not interested in licensing anything to you.
Yeah.
So you're stuck. That you don't want to break the law, but there's no mechanism to easily facilitate, you know, getting a proper license for that. And that's a real problem, because Congress should be creating mechanisms that facilitate commerce in this way, that it's very easy for creators of culture and consumers of culture to transact. And that's why we have mechanical royalties, for example. Like, if you do a cover of a song, you don't have to get permission. You just have to, you know, write the check to the proper, you know, to the Harry Fox agency, and you're covered on that. Mm. But for, you know, putting a early sound recording in a film, it's a gray area, and I think a lot of people are I don't want to say they're skating on thin ice, because I think the risk is relatively low. But, you know, if you try to get it into a festival and then you don't have the proper paperwork, the festival may say, sorry, you know, we need to see clearances on all the music in your film. And it may simply not be possible, either because the record companies never wrote you back, or because you can't find the record company. They've been out of business for 60 years, you don't know where they... what the corporate successor is.
This is something, as a instructor, my students are endlessly fascinated with.
With copyright?
Yeah. And it's usually coming from a place of, I want to use it, why can't I use it? You know, and I tell them the same thing. Although for festival use, there's a festival use law, I believe.
Uh-huh.
It's only when you sell it,
getting,
or you want to sell it,
trying to get distribution,
then yeah. you will hit a wall. Because I've seen things in festivals where I'm like, there's no way that they paid for this Miles Davis recording.
Right, right. Right.
And I think if you just want to stop there, that's okay. But if you hope to do anything else with it, you have to pay. And it's something that, because we have so much free access to everything, it drives them crazy. Like, why can't we?
Right.
It's right on my YouTube. It's on my Spotify. Why can't I use it? So it's still an issue. And that's just modern stuff.
Right.
To go back to, say, 1915, because you would think, yeah, well, no one's alive, right? They're most probably all gone. What's the harm? No one's making any money off of it. And as you say, the curators of this and the re-releasers of this catalog is not even the ones who probably own it.
Yeah, so it could be.
Yeah, RCA is not putting out stuff from, well, you said it was Sony owns RCA, which also owned Victor.
Right.
So they're not going to put it out. You would think they would be the ones who would put it out. But in fact, it's small boutique labels that put that stuff out. So it's not interested in it.
Right. I mean, if it's not going to sell 50,000 units, they're not interested. And you know, these little reissues of, you know, some Ukrainian fiddle player from 1922 or something,
yeah.
I mean, has real historical value, musical value, and it may sell 2,500 units. But you can't run a record label that way, or at least not the kind of multinational record label with expense accounts and limousines and New York office buildings. I mean, so a lot of that stuff languishes, and then independent producers, or what we see is people in Canada and Europe, because the copyright law is different, where you have a 50-year law in Canada and Europe, and you can put it out legally there. You can't sell it in the United States, but it ends up here anyway.
Yeah. That's all those bootleggers going across the border, smuggling in.
Yeah, right, yeah. Ships going from Windsor to Detroit, right? But we love the independent filmmakers. I mean, I get emails probably every week from somebody somewhere who's doing something. You know, I'm not a filmmaker, so the creative process behind that is not something I totally know. But, when you're putting together a film and, you know, the music part of it is so important to you. You know, you're probably looking everywhere and you find that perfect piece of music or sound effect or whatever that helps you tell your story. And if it happens to be a, you know, 100-year-old wax cylinder, I don't want somebody compromising their artistic vision because of either we're bureaucratic or, you know, the law is flawed or something like that. So I always encourage people to, you know, they need to do their due diligence and they need to assess the risks, particularly if they're going to try to commercially release it. But we encourage people to use the recordings in their films.
Do you have a wish list of changing copyright law? If you could be in charge one day, what would ease a lot of these problems?
Well, there's a couple things. The common, it's 1923, I guess, is the date now that is the cutoff. You know, before 1923, everything's public domain. After, it's protected by copyright. I'd like to see sound recordings harmonized with that. So we had a public domain and sound recordings. It was, let's just say, before 1923. And after 1923, they'd be still protected. And then I want that year to move every year. The year should move every year. There should be another batch of stuff that comes into the public domain. That's the whole spirit of that principle. But that moving wall has been stuck for almost 20 years because of the copyright extension. And, you know, Congress can do what they want, but I think the wall starts moving again in a couple years again in 2018. But I want to see a public domain for sound recordings and that wall begin to move. So every year there's another years for the recordings that they're free for the public to use for, you know, making films or doing remixes or whatever else they want to. Yeah. Want to do.
I don't know too much about you, though. What? How did you get to Santa Barbara?
Well, I studied music in college. And
where?
I went to Oberlin College in Ohio.
Oh.
And
where are you from?
No, I'm from Denver, actually.
Are you from Denver? Yeah. Born in Denver.
Denver, yeah.
Born and raised in Denver, right?
Born and raised in Denver.
Uh-huh.
Off to college in Ohio. And I guess the way I like to tell my story is that During college, I did two things. I worked at the radio station, the campus radio station, which was a freeform station not unlike KCSB here in Santa Barbara. And I worked at the Conservatory Music Library, which is one of the two or three biggest music libraries in the country. And there I saw sort of all of musical culture, you know, laid out before me. The Western classical tradition primarily, with some jazz thrown in the library, which was staffed by professionals and curated, and lots of money went into acquisitions and preservation and all that kind of stuff. And then the radio station, which was all that other music that nobody took seriously or cared about.
Do you have a show?
I did. I guess you could call it. I did freeform classical, you know, mostly 20th century classical shows.
Oh, really? Yeah. What was your show? Do you have a title for your show?
It was called Discreet Music, named after Brian Eno's record.
Oh, good taste.
I do have excellent taste. So, so I was learning. On the other hand, and the student radio station there was run by students, and there were so many interesting people, and everybody knew 100 times more about popular culture than, well, I should say their knowledge of popular culture, which was entirely self-taught, was equal to the academic side of thing with the knowledge of Western classical music and jazz. And I said, you know, these two things shouldn't be separate. They're both equally valid. The expressive quality is, there's not a difference between Mozart and Depeche Mode. And so I kind of, as my career kind of formed in my mid-20s, I wanted to do something along those lines. And the idea of becoming an audio archivist, which is, a subset of being an archivist, which is in itself kind of a subset of library science, took form, and I ended up here curating this collection, which has, you know, is this giant collection of obscure music of, you know, that isn't necessarily, you know, the record companies threw out their archives and didn't preserve it, and the big institutional archives like this are really what we have left of these, you know, this whole first half of the 20th century in terms of culture. Now, you know, the Duke Ellington and the Louis Armstrong and everything like that, I mean, that's been well preserved and well documented, but there are literally tens of thousands of recordings that, particularly if not for private collectors who've been doing this for decades of crate digging, as we call it, of going to the flea market and going to the junk shop and finding, you know, they're the ones that rediscovered those old Ukrainian fiddle players from the 20s and then made them known. And I guess one thing I'm trying to do is take that impulse and kind of bring it into the institution. That crate digging impulse, where we have the resources to kind of, really do it for long term, you know, because collectors die and then their kids throw out the collections. And I mean, it happens, you know, some collections get handled properly, but, you know, it's tragic when, you know, that sort of thing happens. But, you know, UCSB, the University of California, you know, hopefully will be here longer than any of us. And, you know, this collection will be around for a long time for people to enjoy. And as a giant archive that's preserved for posterity of all this, all these recordings.
Were you a collector before you did any of this?
Yeah, I was. I think almost all people that go into libraries and archives have some passion for, you know, physical media in the sense of, you know, your book lovers or record collectors or whatever else. So yeah, I do. I don't do it. I scratch most of my itch at work now, so I don't do a lot of collecting now. But I spent probably every weekend in high school and college at record stores.
What were you collecting?
That's a very hard question, but I collected a lot. I started out collecting jazz, and then I collected some classical. And then when I got into pop music, my real thing was sort of late 60s, early 70s kind of experimental music. As Ted knows, I'm a fan of Can. They're my favorite band.
That is your favorite band?
Yeah, it is my
favorite. Really? Okay.
Yeah. And then that sort of whole, the way that collided with punk rock and turned into sort of post-punk.
Yeah.
And I think those echoes are still reverberating today. We've got, you know, with bands like Radiohead or whoever who have taken all these threads that developed in music back in those days and are doing something new with them. And of course, making myself sound totally square by saying Radiohead, because there's 100 new bands that are probably doing stuff that I don't even know about anymore. But
well, yeah, how can you keep up?
It's impossible.
But it's still vinyl for you, right?
It's still vinyl, although yeah. Mostly it's Santa Barbara, you got to have a Sonos system and listen to it online, right?
Yeah, that's right. It is kind of and you can get a vinyl adapter, right, for the Sonos.
Yeah, my turntable at home goes right into my
Sonos.
Right
into your Sonos? God. That's right. They knew, right? They knew.
Yeah.
They didn't want to make it separate. They wanted to put all that stuff together. I also want to request that for the page, we do find that Ukrainian fiddle player. We got to find that.
Paolo Hymeniuk, yeah.
Is that who we're talking about?
Pablo, yeah. I'm not sure how you say his name, but yeah. We'll find some Ukrainian fiddle music to put online. So,
So to go back to those the wax cylinders, that is less about the music, it seems to me, than the accents and the life that you're getting out of, that you can hear. You're hearing some history in that. What has a...
Well, I mean, there were... I'm not sure that I agree 100%, Ted. I mean, I think they are about the artifacts, preserving a snapshot of recorded sound, sort of regardless of, do you want to listen to it once? Yeah. Do you want to listen to it twice? Not necessarily. And there's exceptions. I mean, there are great performances recorded on cylinder recordings that should be, standard and known by people, and they shouldn't be lost in that format. But there is the historical aspect, and whether it's accents or whether it's performance techniques or different styles of writing or proto musics, the music that became before jazz, before ragtime, how those developed into those genres. That's what we have encapsulated on those recordings. So they're important for academic study in that sense, even if they're not aesthetically enjoyable. But I don't think we should dismiss early recordings as not having aesthetic value. It takes harder to, and this is where if we'd had a sort of the curated boutique approach to things, we would have just put out the ones that are really great to listen to. But we've also done that. We have this thing, we have these thematic playlists on the archive, and you can go and listen to, 20 minutes of ragtime cylinders or historical speeches. And this is stuff that people, the curators in the sense of myself or volunteer curators from around the country who have put together their favorite list to share with the world. And that gives people an easy way into the collection. Okay, let's listen to some banjo recordings. But I've already sifted through the 300 banjo recordings to pull out 10 that are really exceptional.
Yeah. Do you have any trepidations on digital as an archival medium? Do you worry about the disk just stops spinning or the cloud goes away? Or?
Yeah, I think, I have trepidations, but I'm not a Luddite, and digital is our only solution. The idea of, engraving these on gold-plated CDs that last 500 years, which if you read tech stuff, there's always some article about some kind of newfangled thing or cuneiform tablets or whatever, but... frankly, digital is what we're stuck with, the same way that in the 1950s we were stuck with magnetic tape, which is a totally great yet flawed medium as well.
Yeah.
So as archivists, it's a pragmatic profession. We have to deal with what we've got, which means being extra careful about backups and that sort of thing, and not putting everything on the Amazon cloud in case they turn it off or go out of business, that kind of thing. I mean, we have real-world concerns with digital, but it is the medium. The argument over analog versus digital doesn't, I don't want to say it doesn't interest me, but, it's not an argument that I don't know. It's settled as far as I'm concerned. I mean, digital is our preservation. I'm a vinyl collector, but digital is our preservation media.
Yeah.
And at the crazy resolutions we're digitizing at back here, it's way better than what you find on a record.
Do you have a sense of how big the collection is in terms of what is possibly out there and what you have?
For cylinder recordings, we think there were about 75,000 titles recorded during that time period.
Mm-hmm.
So from 1896-ish to 1928, between the United States and Europe and a few other places, about 75,000 titles, of which we have 15,000 or so.
Mm.
So math isn't my strong suit, but we're less than 20% of the titles that were mm-hmm. released are in the archive here. Mm-hmm. That's pretty good. If we had 20% of the world's known books here at the library, this would be the largest library on the planet without question. So there's a good chunk, but you know, the thing is that you see those same 16,000 titles over and over and over again. It's those other, you know, 50,000 titles that maybe they're lost. Maybe there's one copy in a collection, or maybe it's at the Library of France, National Library of France, or something like that. So the long tail in this case is very, very long and diminishes quickly because so much has been lost over the past 100 years.
What about the 10-inch?
The 78s, I think we're talking well over during that time between 1900 roughly and say a little after World War II, the early 50s, maybe a million, maybe 2 million. I mean, I don't know the exact number, but it's in the low millions in terms of the numbers of titles that were issued. And we have a couple hundred thousand. So again, we're you know,
still pretty good.
But we're still in the kind of the 20% sort of range. But then there are archives like the EMI archive in London has the output of the very formative gramophone company, which then became EMI, of course, the record label for the Beatles and beyond. But in those first couple of decades, they recorded something like 18,000. I should say in the first few years, they recorded something like 18,000, what they call Berliners over in England, which are 7-inch, 78 RPM discs. And all 18,000 of them are at the EMI archive in London, and probably 5 of them have been reissued. You know, they're just fiendishly rare, probably only known copies on most of that stuff. And we will never have that portion of the corpus in our collection just because it exists as a unique collection there. So there's a lot of it we won't have, but the percentage we do have, it's very substantial. It keeps growing, and it's international, which is that's what makes me excited. Is there's records from, you know, there's Indonesian records, and there's Argentine tango and Cuban zone and all kinds of cool stuff.
Is it easy to find those discographies? Because you need a checklist sometimes, right? To see what is out there than what you have. Is that easy?
It depends. I mean, there's good documentation for some labels, and there's zero documentation for other labels. Collectors tend to collect what is well documented, so they get a book like Brian Rust's Jazz Records, and that becomes kind of their Bible, where they go through that and they say, okay, I don't have this Louis Armstrong record, but I have this one, and they kind of collect that way. That's what I did. My Bible back in the day was the Trouser Press record guide, and I would just go through it and say, I'm going to go to the record store this weekend and look for this Gritty Politti record or whoever it was. And people tend to collect that way. But for a lot of this stuff, the discographies haven't been done yet. So, you know, the really forward-thinking collectors, the really smart ones are out there breaking ground ahead of the research, and then they often are the ones doing the research and doing the documentation. But there's a vast amount of unknowns about a lot of these recordings. There's almost probably more unknown than there is known at this point.
The unknown knowns.
The unknown knowns.
As a great mind once said. Last question, because we have no idea who's listening to this, is there any request that you want to put out? If someone's sitting on a pile of something, what are you looking for?
Well, where we're really growing a lot is in the ethnic and foreign recordings. So, you know, there's got to be stashes of, you know, the archive of some Spanish language radio station from the 40s that must be somewhere out there, you know, and that would be great. But I encourage people to, you know, if they've got 78s or cylinders, to don't chuck them, to at least have somebody look at them. I think, I mean, we have had a policy pretty much of taking any donation that anybody could bring in, at least to evaluate it. And almost from this time period, almost every collection you get in, there's some treasure in it, whether it's an acetate recording, you know, one-off thing that was a radio air check that, you know, might be a unique copy. Or, you know, it could be all like Perry Como records, which are, you know, I'd rather break them than keep them. I shouldn't say that because we don't know.
Maybe Perry Como's family's listening.
But it could be 50 Perry Como records and then one something of great significance, and, yeah, and yeah, for people to just put them out on the curb and not, you know, is they should call us. So
yeah,
we're kind of, I say we're the county agent of early sound recordings. You know, you can call us up and we'll answer your questions and diagnose your problems and recommend a solution as if it were your orange tree had leaves with brown spots on them or something like that.
Okay, good. So, good to know. Well, David, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you, Ted. It's been fun.
Good. All right. Cheers.
There you have it, folks. David Soibert in conversation with me on the Funk Zone podcast. I was just thinking, not only did he introduce me to, well, get me back in the vinyl, but he has a copy of Tortoise's TNT on vinyl. And I saw that thing, I'm like, I wish I could get that. And I looked at the prices on eBay, and yeah, it ain't gonna happen. Man, that's a great album, though. And I'm sure it's even better on vinyl, because I'm that kind of guy. Hey, if you want to discuss vinyl versus CDs or whatever you listen to these days, streaming, digital, what? Who knows how you listen to things, right? If you want to debate that with me, feel free. I'm always up for that discussion. And how could you do that? Well, you could find me on Twitter at Ted Mills. I also have a page called TedMills.com with my writing on it. And you can also go over to Facebook and find me on Funk Zone Podcast page there. And as usual, find us on iTunes and Stitcher. Okay, that is it, folks. Until next week, what do you think about daylight savings? I'm enjoying it. I'm usually making these things as the sun goes down. And look, the sun's still up. It's a nice, nice day here in Santa Barbara. So I'm enjoying that extra hour that suddenly appeared out of nowhere. I hope you're doing well. All right, that's it. I'm going to leave the last word to my second grade friend, Joe. Take it away, Joe. See you later, folks. Bye.
And now for a big goodbye. See you soon. We'll make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make some more tapes later on. Bye. We might make more tapes later on. Yeah. See you soon. Bye.